a bit of a general question, though, and I think we can get a little more specific in a way that could be useful. In particular, so I should say at first, I guess, that the movement calls like of eco-phenomenologists, so the phenomenologists that are thinking about this, these questions, there is a much more of a focus on materiality in experience, which basically just means like the things around us and the things that we are, like as material beings, like the ways our bodies experience the world, the actual objects and physical forms around us and how that affects our experience. And so in line with that, I think it'd be useful to ask just sort of what is the difference in regards to our senses and bodies and the way that they encounter the world between being in a place like this, where there are trees and grasses and the open sky, versus being in a place where you're surrounded by mass-produced human artifacts. And so, like, does anyone have any ideas about what the experience of mass-produced things, like how that's different, just at the like physical level, than interacting with like natural things? Any thoughts? Yeah.
I'm thinking of being in an airport, which I consider the most inhumane place. And it's hard, and it's bright, and its angles, hard, sharp angles.
You know, something else, I think when you're experiencing mass-produced material, whatever, it's a lack of specificity. I mean, here, you know, these, they're all ponderosa pines, but each one is different nonetheless, and they belong here. When you're living in the world of technology and stuff, it's all the same everywhere, and you can't get away from it. There's no place. And here, there's a real sense of place. That's an awfully overused term, but it's legit, I think. And I come from background, my training is in forestry, but I worked as an urban planner, and I'm concerned about what's happened to urban design when we no longer walk to get around. We're always in the same kind of container everywhere, the same, you know, and that's how we see the world through the through holes in this container, and we're not present.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good insight, and I think that's like that's a really important thing to consider, is that by definition, mass-produced things are all the same, because that's the point of mass production, is that they have to be nearly identical copies of one another to be what they're intended to be. And so that certainly has a huge impact on our experience when we're surrounded by really non-specific things. Does anyone have anything else? Yeah.
I was just thinking about my children. My son, you know, give him like a toy truck and play with it for a little while, but give him a bunch of sticks and he spends hours and hours doing a thousand different things with them. So creativity, maybe.
David, you had your hand up first.
I wanted to kind of piggyback on this point a little bit. You're talking about the ponderosa pines all being different from each other, all being specific. But I think it's also true that the reason why they're specific is because the way that they're different shows their history, shows like the particular way in which the wind was blowing like this, or in which a fire came through then, or in which all of these different smaller and larger factors are what made them be different.
Yeah,
and so that uniqueness ties into history and a past and a story that's a different story for every one of them.
Well, and I think with the modern world, especially the airport example, we've become completely desensitized to the energy of other living things. And so, you know, you think about the practice of forest bathing that they do in other countries, where you just walk quietly through a forest and you can pick up the energies that come from other living things. And that's, you can't pick that up from an airport bench or something like that.
Yeah, David mentioned to me earlier that a good thing to consider is the fact is how disconnected these objects are physically from their origins materially. So it's so hard to tell what an airport chair is made of,
right,
just by interacting with it. Like, you're not connected to it as a once living thing or once like natural thing. Mm-hmm. It's just this object that's completely removed from any association with what it really is physically.
I'm from here, and then I lived in upstate New York for a long time, and now I'm back here. And one of the things that I was surprised by that was a fascinating thing to observe, the difference between the places, is that upstate New York has way more trees than Montana does.
Yeah.
And and way more different kinds of trees. Uh-huh. And you know, he says, these are all ponderosa pines. Well, you go there, and the trees are like as close together as they can possibly be.
Yeah.
And there's other vines and everything. It's just jungle.
Yeah.
And there's so much biodiversity. It's in just, you know, you can't even figure it out. And I had a certain amount of agoraphobia when I would come back to Montana because of it. Because I got, at first when I got there, I was like, you get claustrophobic because you can't see ever anywhere because it's always trees. You know, I wasn't in New York City where it's always buildings. Mm-hmm. I was upstate where it's always trees. If it's, the only time there's not trees is if there's water, mm-hmm. you know, there's lakes and rivers. And here, there's so much more openness. Even here, we're in a forest, and you can still see quite a bit through it, where when you're in a world like that, you can't see very far at all, ever. You really need a compass, that's for sure.
Yeah. So certainly different natural things will have a variety of different sorts of experiences, different environments will be different from one another as well. That's probably with much higher diversity than like different cities, as far as that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and even in New York City itself, there are areas where there are, you know, big rock outcroppings and stuff like that, where you see that that it's a it's a stony place, which is part of why it can support those massive skyscrapers. It's because there's so much solid stone in the substrata of the earth there. It's, you know, we just imagine it being from here that it's, you know, it's just all, you know, Ava Gabor, New York is where I'd rather stay, you know, and then it's all just skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. And it's more complicated than that.
So what about another aspect of mass-produced objects, of their physical form, is that they just tend to be just a lot simpler than like natural things. And this kind of goes back to the lack of diversity of them, that they're like exact copies, is they also tend to be really as streamlined as they can be, as simple as they can be. Like you don't get those hard angles and smooth surfaces in nature. You only get them in an airport, where mm-hmm. it's constructed to just do that particular, a function that it's supposed to do as simply as it can. And I think that's another part. So we have like a few major things that differentiate mass-produced objects from natural objects in our experience, which, one is that they are as similar to one another as they can be. Another is that they are as simple in themselves as they can be. And I think there seems to be a few reasons for this, like, or there seems to be a few effects that this has, I guess you could say. The fact that they're all copies of one another is interesting to I'm sure many of you who've come to like previous philosophy events are familiar with Plato and Plato's idea of forms. So Plato is an ancient Greek philosopher who, and there's a lot of different interpretations of Plato, and a lot of people don't think he really thought there was a world of forms outside the world that everything's an example of. But the oversimplified explanation of Plato is that he believed that, you know, when you encountered a tree, you were encountering an imperfect copy of a tree. That would, there's some perfect ideal for a tree out there, or in your mind, or whatever, that all trees are just imperfect copies of. But that the real tree, the real essence of tree, is some like perfect original tree. And so what's interesting to me, thinking about Plato's theory of forms and thinking about mass-produced objects, is the fact that they're not imperfect copies. They're almost perfect copies. Mm-hmm. And so what's an iPhone? What is an iPhone a copy of? it almost feels like the way we encounter it, to me, and maybe this isn't true for everybody, but it sort of feels like we're encountering like almost a perfect ideal of whatever the thing is that we're using. Like if you're picking up like a mass-produced hammer, that's like pure just like the idea of a hammer. It almost doesn't have a specificity, but in addition to like what goes along with that specificity is like a material presence. Like I think it's harder to connect to the hammer as an object in the first place. It's just the idea of itself. And what adds to this is that simplicity of the form and the way it lacks anything that doesn't go along with just performing its function. And what that I think its physical characteristics are basically like as minimal as they can be. I mean, an example, sorry, I'm being a little scattered right now, but and why this I think is significant is because it makes us focus only on the function of that object, which further distances us from its material presence as a thing. It further distances us from paying a physical kind of attention to the object, because we're so concerned with just what it does. We just use it. We don't see it or interact with it in any other meaningful way. And so, for instance, if someone broke into your house one night and stole your TV remote and replaced it with a different remote, that still performed the same function. So long as it didn't have any obtrusive physical characteristics that got in the way of it turning on your TV, you wouldn't really care. And so these kinds of objects, there's a philosopher of technology named Albert Borgman, who's at the University of Montana, and he calls when objects that we perceive as only our function, and that we don't care, that are completely replaceable, that we don't care whether it's one or another of the thing, so long as it performs the function, these are called shallow objects. Because a shallow object is just one where its physical characteristics don't matter at all. Its specific characteristics don't matter at all. And so we don't care about the thing itself. And so your TV remote is a shallow object. Your razor might be a shallow object. Your deceased great-grandfather's straight razor from World War II would probably be a deep object. Mm-hmm. Because you would care about it in its specificity.
It's rarer too.
Yeah. And it's less common and easy to replace. Yeah, go ahead. So you're right. So people are very attached to their phones, but I still would consider that a shallow object. A shallow object is something that you interact with only for its function. Like a deep object matters in its physical particularity. Okay. So the difference here is that functionally, you care about the variety of diverse functions your cell phone can do. You might care about the fashion statement your shirt is wearing, but you don't care about the like physical object of the shirt itself. It's not something that's like precious to you in the same way as something that has a deep significance in its like form, in itself. So like no matter, you know, how many like unique apps you put on your cell phone, no matter how much time you spend on it or how much you care about the phone, it's not really the phone you're caring about, it's what it does. And I think that's what differentiates a shallow from a deep object. Yeah.
I guess I want to push back on that, because it seems like what differentiates the shallow object is replaceability, not function.
So replaceability is a big part of it, and your phone could be like very easily replaced as well by another phone that performed the same function. And so that's the replaceability and function, that's the relationship, is that so long as you can replace it with something that performs the same function for you, it doesn't matter. The thing itself doesn't matter.
I came home one day, and everything in my apartment had been replaced by exact replicas. Mm-hmm. And I asked my roommate, I said, hey man, what's going on? And he said, who are you?
So, that's great.
All right, couldn't resist.
So that's another example.
You're living in a Borges short story, is that what you're saying?
That's a great segue into what I think is a better example of a deep object, which is another human being. Because, you know, someone could break into your house and switch your TV remote with another TV remote that does the same thing, or your phone with another phone that has the same apps. But if they replaced your child with another child that was mostly the same, or even was exactly the same,
right.
but you knew that it wasn't the same child, you would really care about the loss of that specific thing. And that's a good way to draw that distinction.
Yeah. And body like, snatchers.
Yeah. So I think that, like, to go a little further with this, when you're interacting with things that you only care about for their function, and when we're inundated in a world of these technological objects that we're so used to not really caring about in their material specificity, I think that there's certainly some bleed over that happens, where when we go and look at the natural world, or when we consider the natural world without having a personal relationship to the specificity of things in nature, it becomes a lot easier to view nature the same way, to view trees as just a collection of resources, to view a forest as completely replaceable by another forest that you could plant. And so when you lose that attachment, and when you lose that capacity to experience things as deep objects, which I think is a real risk, even with the way we interact with people in technological society. Because, I mean, the Industrial Revolution, which brought on mass production, also brought with it an abuse and a use of people and reducing people to just their function as workers, which turns people from deep into shallow objects that we only care about for their function. And so, yeah, go ahead.
So what about, like, we saw mountain bikers, you know, riding on this trail. Maybe they think any trail would do. Any trail that had the right number of ups or downs, so it could be totally replaceable. So how does that relate to the natural world? Because we all have special trails, but, you know, if it was destroyed or fire, we would go to another trail. I mean, how far does it carry into nature, this replaceability?
Well, I think in the mountain bike example, usually there is a personal connection to the place that you're mountain biking, or there is some way that it affects you. I also think that it's important to sort of stretch our idea of like what that nature or specific interaction is, because like a mountain biker, they might not care about the scenery, and you might be tempted to say, well, that means they don't care about the place, but they probably care about the way the wheels feel and the specific turns on the trail and the contours of the trail itself and how it, and I think that that's still a certain kind of connection. But I would also say there are absolutely people who interact with nature who aren't connected to nature. There certainly also could be mountain bikers who just don't care. And I think we could say, in the context of the way we're talking about it today, that they're not connected to nature, that they're not having a personal connection with their environment in a significant way.
Or a logger.
Or a logger, yeah. There's another sort of related way that I think that mass-produced objects distance us, in that they remove us from needing to attend to the world, because, like, you know, for instance, if you can turn on your tap and just receive water immediately, there's tons of benefits to that. I mean, it's much more sanitary than going to the river and collecting water in buckets, and it has, like, tons of other benefits of convenience. So certainly the benefits outweigh the costs here. But there are still, that doesn't mean there aren't costs. And I think that one of the costs of just being able to get water from the tap is that you no longer have to go out into the world and attend to it, and you're no longer challenged by the world in a way that forces you to attend to it and be present to it. And Heidegger talked about those ways of engaging with the world as practices, that we're lacking in practices in the culture of technology. And that I think that this is another sort of contributing factor in why it's so much easier to view nature as just like as non-specific and reduce it to just resources or treat it in any way that we want, is because we're no longer engaging with it and attending to it in a way that forces us to confront its specificity. I think that there's also an element getting into a conversation of the senses, which is like how our bodies interact with the world. When you have these objects that are so clean and so reduced to just their function, I think it dulls our senses, mm-hmm. and it makes it much easier to go out into nature and to not pay attention to the specificity. We're not practiced in it because we're not challenged to engage with it. We also are just so used to really not being like, not having any difficulty and just not having any like difference in the way we engage with these things, which makes it again easier to not have an intimate sort of relationship with these specific forms. Go ahead.
It sounds like many people are talking about their experience with nature, or the act of experiencing nature and the connection and the practice. I grew up at one point living at the end of a street with open space, climbing trees and building tree forts and playing in the creek and rescuing tadpoles and playing with salamanders and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. And so that's a...
But still in town, but on the edge of town?
Yeah, it was right. In California, the subdivision, right. And then it was just a big
right.
open space.
So it wasn't like out isolated, but it was on the edge.
Right, okay. Right. But it allowed me to have this experience of interacting and mm-hmm. connecting with nature, which is something I truly valued. Another experience I had that I almost hate to admit to because it's so stereotypical of women mm-hmm. and it implies materialistic and the like, is I love to shop. I love going into the stores, mm-hmm. Especially at Christmas time. I love the commercialism, the sparkles, the getting gifts, mm-hmm. and with, of course, all the online shopping that's going on nowadays, shopping malls are shutting down, and I think about people who mm. will not have that experience that I, so enjoy. Mm. And I say, well, they're going to have other experiences, and yeah. why should I value my experience as a shopper above what they're going to experience by going on their iPhone and receiving the packages in the mail and all the issues mm. that go along with that?
I wouldn't be here if it wasn't and for then, Facebook.
And then it makes me wonder if they're going to replace my shopping experience with other experiences that could be considered equally valuable. If people lose nature and replace my experience of being in the creek and climbing the trees with other experiences, who am I to judge that is any less valuable than yeah.
I think that that's an important question, is like, how do we evaluate these things? We could describe their differences, but how do we say that it's necessarily good or bad? But I think that that's something like to personally answer. And I think the usefulness of trying to talk about what these differences are and how we interact with mm-hmm. mass-produced objects and how that affects our interaction with nature is the hope that those are unrecognized differences for some people, that there's an unrecognized loss that's happening in when we're living in a mass-produced and artificial environment, a loss of our experience, a loss of our capacity to connect to other beings. And I guess the hope is also with that people will be affected by that loss, and I believe that there's that loss is personally felt. That not having the more than human community of beings that you can have a connection with on a specific level, that not being engaged and engaging with all the multiple forms of life reduces your sort of fullness of engagement with life. But of course, I can't just say that. That has to be something that people decide for themselves is true.
But I think that given those differences and given the effect that these things have on us, I think that it is true. Sorry, was there other questions? Yeah.
So, the shopping thing, I had an experience a few years ago. I decided to buy nothing, live for a year. Okay, you've seen people do that. So I was on vacation, and I had this overwhelming urge to go shopping. Like, and I'm thinking, every time I go to a new place, I want to go buy something. And why is that? And I had a chance to really think deeply about it because I wasn't going to go shopping. And I think that consumerism tapped into our hunter-gatherer kinds of genetic makeup because, you know, 1,000 years ago, if you were a good shopper, you were probably really valued in the tribe because you could find shit. You could go out and gather it all. And I think that if we look back and where did these ideas come from, it helps us put it in perspective. And then you can say, well, do I want to experience my urge to gather in a shopping mall, or do I want to do it in some other way? But it's that insight that helps. Where does it come from? Because a lot of people have that same desire and urge.
And for me, it wasn't necessarily buying. Movies I ever saw. In that movie, humans, and we don't know what their life experience was like, but they had made the decision that they did not need the natural world around them, that they wanted to live in. Mm-hmm. And that didn't necessarily mean that they had no nature, I would imagine. I mean, they would have trees, they would have flowers, and they'd have insects that they valued for what they could do, that's an example of a society that made the decision that interaction with natural environments